Hello, TSF family, and welcome to episode 20 of season 7 of This Spiritual Fix. Today we are going to be talking about stories and how our subconscious may actually just be a collection of stories that is not unknowable. Enjoy. This spiritual fix. Two mystical mamas hacking the self-help game.
With Anna Stromquist
and Christina Wiltsey.
Hello, Anna.
Hello, Christina. How are you?
I'm well. I think I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. How are you? Because last time we briefly spoke, you said you were feeling discombobulated, like everything was disappearing.
It is, and it's only continuing so, but it's like a good thing because I think that the disappearing has led to being able to see things in a different way, and that's what we're talking about today, but we'll get to that. The villains and their arcs have fully, like, dismantled my life in a wonderful, sometimes challenging way, but dismantled my life and come back in a meaningful way. But you had some things that you wanted to talk about with the prelude, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, it kind of started in two different ways. One is my children take a creative writing class online through OutSchool. We're not endorsed by OutSchool, but I think it's a great online learning platform for kids. And they kind of educate me on things. And one of the things they told me about were some tropes that occur often in literature. And then you start to see it in TV shows and movies and when you're reading a book. And it almost feels like there is this cut and paste way of doing everything in terms of literature. And then somehow it pulled up on my feed on Instagram, this comedian named Delaney Rowe. I think I've sent them to you. It's at DelaneyRowe. And it's so eye-opening because it makes you feel like you've been lied to your whole life by all the movies that have been written and directed and produced by mostly men. Like, now you can totally tell the difference when a movie is written or directed by a female.
Yes.
So in these things, she does these things. She's like, this is the daughter whose mom died, and she takes care of her dad. She's like, good morning, dad. Oh, don't worry about tomorrow. I'll get the newspaper route. You know, and like, she does these caricatures of these. She does stereotypical characters like the quirky way the insufferable female lead is introduced in an indie movie, or the found footage of the wife who dies in the beginning of a holiday movie, or the epic scene at the end of the holiday movie. And it's just like all of these quintessential stereotypical roles.
Yes. Yeah. I was going to say, yeah, like the manic pixie dream girl. That's a classic one. That's like, I feel like Natalie Portman started that in Garden State. And then it was like in so many different ones. And that's like, I could spend all day talking about fictional character arcs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Zooey Deschanel always does that character. And I've sent you some of these, right?
Yes, yes.
And
no,
it's like,
I totally
they're just so
that.
One-dimensional. Mm-hmm. And it's like, mm-hmm. God, these are the role models that we've been giving young girls our whole lives, of these four different stereotypical women. And it's just like super annoying. And I see it and I don't like it, but I also laugh hysterically, and I'll put her link in the show notes. But anyways, back to those creative writing tropes.
Yes.
Like, one is plot armor. I had never heard it said this way, but plot armor is when a character has so much plot invested in them that you know that the author is not going to write them off because there's just so much backstory. And I also feel like maybe there's the term for salary armor, where like the main character is a highly paid actor. You know that in that movie or show, they're not going to be written off because that's a really high paid actor. So you're like, oh yeah, the Daniel Day-Lewis character's not dying, you know, or whatever.
Or if they do, it'll be in a dramatic way at the end, and it will be, you know, stunning. But it's like, maybe Daniel Day-Lewis might die, but like, yeah. And most of the time, they're
not. But
yeah.
Not early on, not in the first 15 minutes. I think that's one of the reasons why I really love Game of Thrones, because he threw out the plot armor, and you would have characters die off when you least expected it. And I kind of liked that, the shocking part of that. So
yeah.
Anyways.
Yeah.
So another literary trope that's often used is the fish out of water. And then once I learn this, I see it everywhere and it almost drives me crazy because I'm like, this is so annoying. Like, I can kind of tell a good book from a bad book or a good show from a bad show based on if they're going to employ this trick or not. It's similar to like an Alien Among Us or, you know, fish out of water. It's like there's someone who's not where they're supposed to be or in a new place. And it's the way of introducing all the characters, the environment, the structure to the viewer or the reader, right? And, right, and like so. An example is I just started watching Fallout. And in the show, Lucy leaves her Fallout shelter and she's suddenly the fish out of water. She's introduced to this and that and this. And you start to see the way the world is working based on her being a fish out of water. And then like I just started this one that was Golden Globe nominated. I think it won a few things. It's called The Pit. On
oh,
HBO.
I love The Pit. I loved it.
I just started it. But like, yeah. of course, in the first 10 minutes of the show, the student interns are here and like, hey, intern, that's Dr. So-and-so. And this is Dr. So-and-so. And this is the ER. And this is the waiting room. And this is it's like, what, like they're fish out of water, right? They're new to mm-hmm. this environment. Anyways, I'm just noticing it. And I kind of feel like I've been betrayed and cheated in a lot of ways because these authors and directors and screenwriters are using the same freaking tricks and tools constantly and stereotypes of women often. And I've been falling for it hook, line, and sinker my whole life. And now that I see it, I'm like, argh! But anyways, that's what I wanted to contribute to today's episode.
Well, so can I tell you this? This is so why it's so funny that it like totally it totally ties into what we're talking about. Okay, so for one thing, the fish out of water, I can guarantee you they're either probably an obedient critic, and that's the arc that the character is going to be on, or they're a divisive immortal, right? Because both of those deal with outcasts or imposters, and like they don't belong, and they're trying to learn the rules, especially if it's like a single person, you're going to find that either they're going to be like, having to understand this new world, and like part of their arc is going to be about belonging and like how do they actually start to belong, or part of it's going to be about survival. So for instance, Lucy from Fallout, totally survival, right? Totally like she's having to survive, and who does she ally with, and who does she like do the thing that she needs to do with? Whereas like, you know, in The Pit, doctors are classically obedient critics, like especially people who went to medical school because they felt like they needed to have a certain status or because their family told them to or something like that. Like doctors, you're going to have obedient critic arcs. Absolutely. So I think it's funny that you're talking about these tropes because this is the thing that I find interesting when, you know, I did this, I did probably way too much on this, but I was like really into it for a little bit, but now I'm so out of it. I'm just like, oh, I'm so sick of it. But I will say that Stranger Things, I don't know if you watched the last season. Did you watch the last season? Okay, so for about 6 months ago, I did a character analysis for each of the characters, and I was like, these are the arcs that they're in. This means that they could die, or this means that they don't die, right? Like, it was like, I was like, because the plot armor is their character arc. Like, if you were to kill off somebody who that wasn't in their arc at all to die, like, it wasn't a part of it, like, being sacrificial or having to have an ego death or any of these other things. There are a couple of the arcs that we've talked about this season with the inner villains that death or death processes are like a very key part of the arc, right? So you can do it psychologically and meditatively, or you can do it elsewhere. And I feel like when an author or a script writer changes those things, it's like that to me is the hallmark of bad, because I think we sense these arcs, right? I think that we sense them. And to your point, most women fall usually in the vengeful martyr, which is what you described, right? They usually fall in the vengeful martyr, or they fall in one of these other arcs. And men don't know how to write women because they don't understand the complexity of what it comes into these arcs that they're usually not familiar with, right? And so if you have a woman who happens to be in a very classically male arc, which is like the evasive expert, perfect example of an arc in which you almost never, it's like the Sherlock Holmes and the this and that, right? Like those really sleuthy addicts who are incredibly intelligent but have absolutely no emotional intelligence whatsoever. Like Sherlock Holmes is a classic hero example of an evasive expert. You know, you then switch to some other person. I was watching Murder at the End of the World with Britt Marling. I think you watched it a couple of years ago. I only finally just started watching it. And, you know, it's fascinating because it's the same thing. She's effectively like Gen Z Sherlock Holmes. She's the evasive expert, and they do a really good job of writing her, but it is a woman that's falling into a traditionally male character arc. All right, so what we're going to be talking about today, which is why what Anna talked about is so amazing, is that I just want to kind of take you guys on this journey of where I've been going, because I have had a lot of really kind of crappy crap happen, right? I guess I don't even want to judge it because I don't feel upset about it and I don't feel like a victim of it. So from an outside perspective, losing your house to mold and having to like move into an RV, and then I have to get surgery this Friday for like a biopsy, which, you know, we kind of, I don't know if we mentioned it before, but you know, I'm actually really not worried about that at all. But it's like, it was so interesting because there's just these series of events of things that happen. And I know that this is like an ego death for me. Like, I know that this is 100%. The way that I see it is that a lot of structures that exist in my life have to shift and change. And sometimes in your life, whether that's, it's for whatever reason, you have to go on a harder path than you might get to otherwise. So I consider luck something that you can kind of cultivate in your life, right? This is something that I teach people that I talk to and things like that, in the sense that luck is when you really listen to yourself and you really listen to the world around you, and you're kind of trying to navigate the world by like magnetizing yourself to like a lesson and the easiest version of a lesson, right? So an example of that could be like, oh, you really need to stop commuting to that job because the commute to your job is killing you. And like, it's really, really bad for you to do this. The worst version of this is you have to get in an accident, which means that you can't go to the job and you're going to get fired. The easiest version is that, you know, your car breaks down and somebody comes to help you with your car who happens to invite you or connect with you that makes it so that you then get offered another job, right? It's like effectively the same thing happens. Like, you can feel that your story is like saying, I don't want to go to the job anymore. I don't want to do this job and I don't want to do this commute. And it's like, you kind of have different versions of this, but you can't always get out of the hard lesson, right? You can't always get out of the more difficult and deep iteration of how your story wants to play out. We know this, and we talked a lot about this with Jeff Brown a couple seasons ago, so many seasons ago, when he talked about needless suffering, right? That like needless suffering is like in many ways the most difficult version of your own plot, right? And this is it. This is the heart of what, this is the thesis of what I will say, is that I genuinely have been looking at the kind of origin in particular of the subconscious and how we view the subconscious as psychological, you know, as a psychological concept, right? Started with Freud, probably predated that in a lot of ways, but basically the subconscious is what we consider. We have this conscious mind, which is like maybe 10 to 15% of our brain, and the rest of it is the subconscious. And it's this huge batch of repressed emotions and just like these beliefs and all these things. And the subconscious is what's ruling us, but we have no ability to get into it whatsoever. And I am entirely convinced at this point, and this is honestly the most benevolent way that I can see the world, is that the subconscious is not unknowable. The subconscious are the stories that we carry with us, and they have ecology and they have life and they have everything that we are. And I think that especially, I can say this as like a white woman who's lived in a very privileged position, I think that it is incredibly consistent with white privilege to forget the stories of where you've come from, right? And to forget the stories that run through your life. And this relates to the inner villains, because at this point, my running hypothesis is that the nine villains are nine stories that run through our subconscious. It's like a structure to our subconscious. Does that make sense, Anna? Yeah. Okay. And the best way I can kind of describe it is this. I oftentimes, when I work with people, I talk about this idea of the tree and the roots, and how we as individuals, especially in Western culture, are taught that we are just the tree, right? We're just the tree that is above the ground, right? We're the canopy, we come out, we have periods in which we have leaves, we reproduce, and then we have saplings, and then we die. And that is the like sum total of our experience on Earth. And yet we never come into contact with what it is to be the root system. And in Richard Powers' book, The Overstory, the botanist in that talks about the nature of the root system as not being distinguishable from one species to another, right? That like, if you go into the root system, all of the roots of all the trees connect to each other, and there's no separation between all of these different trees, right? Like there's like all of the plants are completely connected. There's no like, this is me, this is you, this is this person. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's a network, and there's no need to distinguish one individual from another. If one part of the network needs help, the whole system comes in together to help that part of the network. And I feel like we have a understanding of the fact that almost, I can guarantee you, the vast majority of oppressed groups have an understanding of these stories that they carry with them, right? Because their ancestors have lived it and it's been necessary for their survival in order to be able to carry it through, right? Every single thing in nature understands the nature of these stories that are carrying through. I choose to call these threads that move through our lives, we call them inner villains, we call them arcs. I have a tendency to call them stories. The Aboriginals in the Dreamtime, so if you guys are familiar with Aboriginals in Australia, they believe that they inherit songs ancestrally from the land as well as from their ancestors, and their job is to pick up those stories and carry them and sing them because they have to keep them alive, right? They have to keep them alive because they inherit the story and their job is to continue the story. And so they sing songs in order to be able to actually carry through the story, right? They call them songs, but in any case, you have all of these different cultures around the world who understand the nature of what guides us on a subconscious level, or I don't know what other word you want to use for the subconscious, but we're just going to use subconscious for the sake of this. And that I have finally come into that understanding in the most deep and visceral way, because I have had so many things happen in the last couple of months, and I'm going to tell you guys a story of what I mean. So my mom died of breast cancer right when I was 6. And so I reconnected with her ex-boyfriend, who was her ex-fiance just before she died. And he was the one who went through all of her cancer treatments with her. I didn't actually know for the longest time that she had gone through cancer treatments at all, because the only source that I had for information about her was my dad, who was divorced from her, right? Or from friends who weren't there. And so this ex-fiance told me about what it was like to go through cancer treatment with her, which was very eye-opening to me. And it really gave me a very vastly different perspective on what she went through and how she was like a mom to us most of the time. And then working, like, he said that she'd go to chemo on like a Tuesday or a Monday night. And that was like the night and the day that I was with, like my sister and I were with my dad. She would go on the Monday night and then she'd just like be sick all day on Thursday, like not able to get out of bed. And then she would be working by Tuesday night at the theater, like performing or something like that, and kind of doing this. But the most amazing thing that he told me, and this is it, and because it has so much relevance, is that she got a mastectomy. So I didn't know that she had gotten a mastectomy. And he told me about this scar that she had that went from the middle of her chest all the way around to her armpit, right? And it was this, I've just been kind of obsessed a little bit with this scar, because a month or so ago, I thought about it and I was like, isn't that so interesting that my sister had open heart surgery And she has a scar that goes from the middle of her clavicle all the way down to her chest, like, you know, her thymus, right, in between, right? So she has a scar from her open heart surgery. And I was like, isn't that funny? Isn't that funny that, like, what a strange coincidence that, you know, our mom had this scar that went from her chest around to her armpit, and you have half of that scar. I was like, isn't that a funny coincidence, right? And then I found out that I needed the biopsy, and I found out that I'm getting the second half of the scar. Right? So, yeah.
Yeah. Her story split. That's nuts.
Isn't that nuts? Right? It's like, and so what I came to realize, and this has been like this really fascinating thing, is that one of the things that I know is very prevalent in my mother's story was the experience of being highly exposed and directly exposed to sexual assault as a child from people, from men in her life. And the thing that my sister and I have always commented on, which we thought was so interesting, is that, I mean, I say interesting, but fucking grateful as all get out, is that we've never had that experience. I had some of those experiences before I turned six, but I can genuinely say that after my mom died, I never had those experiences at all, right? And so we always thought it was such a strange thing that, you know, we were told that we were such beautiful girls, but like it never happened. It never happened to us. And one of the things about my mom's experience was that she was obsessed with this idea that, and I say obsessed and like I would be too, is that she directly correlated her sickness, because she was very spiritual and kind of very, this was the nature of her battle, was that she was very, very obsessed with this idea that if only she could remember her abuse, then she could get rid of her illness. Right? And mm-hmm. I was meditating the other morning on this as I woke up, and I was like, okay, so if I'm getting the second half of the scar, and my mom was an only child, right? So there was like many, many generations of sisters, and then my mom was the only one. My mom got the entire scar. Caitlin and I got two halves of the same scar. And then neither of us experienced a massive part of her trauma. And I was like, what if she changed that part of the story? She processed that part of the story on our behalf, right? But she couldn't do it all. She couldn't do it all in one body. And that choice and that movement that she did to move, you know, to effectively pull the pedophilia away, directly away from our family line, right? And it's like, it cost her life, and that was necessary. And then Caitlin got, I think, the heart portion, the heartbreak portion of that, of what was that family line's lineage or that story that hadn't been processed. And I got, I don't know what I got. I don't know yet what I got, but I know that I've done so much work, and you guys have heard me do it on this podcast. I've done so much work around like feeling betrayed by my body and like what it means to want to stay on earth, that like, I think that that's the second half of it, right? Like I genuinely think that it's the second half of it. I also fall into the role of needing to actively protect my children from people, because my daughter had been, I feel like I've reversed it a lot, or I've like changed that charge, but like it was remarkable how many times my daughter ran into men who were interested in her and made kind of moves at her. So I've had to actively like protect her. And so I kind of come into the rescuer as the mother figure who has to protect the daughter, right? But it's like, so far I'm successful in that. I feel like I've been very successful in that. And I hope that that continues to be the case. But you can see how in so many ways we think of ancestral trauma, right? We think of ancestral trauma as this like moment or event that happens. And then our job is to kind of switch it. And I think that's true, but I don't think that's the whole story, because I think that we think that, just like, I'm not going to say this, but like exactly like a privileged person would think, is that you can just have the trauma, process it, and be done with it. But that's not the case. I think that there are stories, and our job is to take the story and recognize that we cannot completely get rid of the story. What we can do is we can steward it, right? Steward it being the word that we've used for retrograde, for all of this kind of stuff, you know, for what it means to heal the villain. It's like we're not getting rid of the villain. It's like we recognize it, we understand it, we are completely aware of it. And what we do is we try and shift the nature of the story towards that luck, towards that kind of easier representation of it. But the story does not fundamentally leave us, right? So that story of my family ancestry of heartbreak caused by men is one that I have just so strongly felt in my life. I know that my relationship with my partner now is helping to heal that part of the story, right? So that my children maybe don't have to experience it in the same way, right? They're going to get to take it, and they're going to have more choice with how they steward the story. And it's not going to feel like a requirement. But yeah, that was a lot. Anna, what do you think?
Well, it's a lot and it's deep. But then this is my brain saying, well, how do you know what Luke brings to the equation?
No,
it's,
I totally
scary,
know.
Because you,
mm-hmm. Go ahead.
What stories could he possibly bring to your children? And can you process the trauma? Our shaman is always saying, whatever trauma, whatever things you release, you're doing it for your future generations, right?
Yes. Yes.
I like to believe that. I definitely want to believe that. If it's genetic or inherited or whatever, how do we protect them from their partner stories?
I do. And I think that's the trick. And that's the thing that is like devastating and liberating all at the same time, which is how it's like the closest I can get to just be like, oh my God, none of this is about me. Like, that's how I feel. I just like, I'm so fucking overwhelmed by this feeling that none of this has to do with me. Like, it's just like, I am just I'm one tiny chink in this massive chain, and I can't protect my children from their story. And right. They're going to combine the story of me and Luke, and then they're going to do whatever they're going to do with it. And my job is to teach them how to steward the story. Right? Because I was talking to Luke about this the other day, and I was like, it's not surprising to me at all that you want to go back to ancestral ways, because think about just in the three people that you can think of that you know in your family line, and the PTSD that his grandfather had, massive shell shock, as they called it back then, from World War II, right? And it affected his ability to function in the world. And it affected dramatically his father and his father's generation, right? And it's like, we have so many men who are trying to process very complex PTSD, generational PTSD, from having to see people mowed down in war and having to see just massive suffering on such a grand scale, right? And like, we forget about it, but every single little boy who is obsessed, like my son, who's obsessed with fucking war stuff, you know what I mean? Like, that's not a mistake to me. They're having to process the story of where that story went collectively, right? The story of what I feel like is a righteous bully or divisive immortal, of like, what it means to have like this force that is trying to kill and destroy everybody, and what it means to protect yours and be like, I'm going to protect mine, but you're different, right? Like, that's a very divisive immortal in particular kind of view. And it's like, they have that story, right? And so we think of it as past lives, right? We think of it as, I have a past life. And one of the things, I don't know if you remember when Ainsley MacLeod said this, one of the things that he said, that the only way is that once you identify you have a past life, the way to stop being so connected to the story is to say and remind your soul that you're not in that life anymore. Do you remember what he used to say? He used to say that you needed to tell the story of your children's past lives to them and be like, and get, and at the end be like, and guess what? You're not in that story anymore. What I would argue to say is you're not that character anymore. Like, you're not playing that same role anymore. Like, you're not the one who died on the battlefield anymore, right? Like, you still have that story, but it's not going to come out in that exact way, right? And so we can't protect our children from their stories, and we cannot prevent, I mean, I've said this forever, I cannot prevent wounding my children. Like, I am absolutely going to do that, but how do I do that how do I recognize that the wounding is part of the story that they are here to play out? The way I say it is, I contain multitudes. I have many stories, and I am contained in multitudes. There are so many stories that I'm a part of. And so I named one story, which has to do with my divisive immortal, which has to do with like my health and being afraid of dying of cancer. That's one of my stories. I have another story, which is my evasive expert story, which is all about my mold and being in a house in which I had to move out. And no matter how intellectual or smart I was about it, or how many times I could try and think my way through it, it did not change the fact that the mold grew, and that, you know, there's like this deep feeling part of my entire family, everybody living in the house, which needed to be connected to through that story of the mold, right? And for some people, it's past lives. For some people, it's ancestral stuff. For some people, and I think that all nine stories run through us in a different way. Sometimes we have what I would call an origin villain, right? So like, I got thrown into the obedient critic arc because I had somebody who had that story so strongly that it became a very clear and present part of my life. And I've thus then had many clients who are obedient critics, and I've had many friends who are obedient critics. And it's this really fascinating thing to keep seeing this story coming up in my life, right? And I can help people with it in particular because I've storted that story in my own life. What do you think? Tear it down, Anna.
Wait, I'm trying to understand. You said you're seeing what come back up in their lives? You just said you're seeing obedient critics.
Oh yeah, no, I have a lot of obedient critic clients. That was like one of the hardest, that was like, I had an origin villain, which is what my kind of term for, I had somebody in my life who was an obedient critic, right? And they were very prominent in my life, right? And since moving through and coming to peace with that in the way that I've processed my experience of being in the obedient critic arc, I now have lots of clients who are obedient critics, and I can help them
through it. Because it's like, you can help them. Okay. Yes, yes, yes.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm naming the fact that I have an origin villain who's an obedient critic. And so that's one way that that story decided to come up, that arc decided to come up in my life.
Right.
The mold and my relationship and my family, we are all evasive experts when we're together. And so the mold was the way that wanted to show up in my life, as a way that like, you need to take care of the place that you live. You need to slow down. You need to make things funny. All the things that we've talked about in the past, like that needed to happen for that story, because that story was very prominent in my life. And then I have this other story, which is the divisive immortal, which is part past life. If anybody listened to that Ainsley MacLeod, he did readings for us. And, you know, he said that I had died, or not died, but I had like, you know, been in a prison for a very long time. And, you know, all these things that which led to my fear of wanting to be in a human body, and all these, blah, 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 blah. You guys can go back and listen to the entirety of this spiritual fix to hear this story. But like, my point is that the complexity of women, to your point, or the complexity of people, is that they will have three or four different stories which are very prominent to them. Those stories can come up because of past lives. Those stories can come up because of ancestry. Those stories can come up because of culture. Those stories can come up because you had an abuser in your life who was like that, or you had a sick sibling, or you had a mother die when you were young. And all of those things are really reasons that these stories become prominent, and our job is to steward them.
Well, it's funny because it really reminds me of you and I having this conversation just last week, where I was complaining because my husband's really bad at time management and executive functioning. His only domestic chore around the house is to take out the trash. He's going to forget to take out the trash or only take out one bin or to forget to take out the boxes that need to go to the curb. And like, I was telling you how he's going out of town soon and I'm actually looking forward to trash day because I usually dread it. And the reason why I dread it is because if it was up to me, I would take everything out the night before and it's just done and I don't have to think about it. And it's like 5 minutes of labor and 5 minutes of mental load. But when he does it, it's like 2 minutes of labor because I have to chase after whatever he forgot and I have to wake him up and remind him. But it's like 12 hours of mental load because I have to keep tabs on it between Wednesday and when the trash people come. So it's actually harder when he does it than when I just do it, right? And I was telling you the story. Do you remember what you told me?
I said it was a setup, right? It's like a perfect setup. So basically you have created a setup in which you get to be the savior. You get to like get mad at him and be righteous about this one task. He has one task, you're one task, right? Like, it's like this idea of like, I'm giving you this one task and you cannot achieve this one task. He never does it. He doesn't, whether it's because of any of the reasons that we have, like learned helplessness, weaponized incompetence, or executive functioning, right? Like all these things which are, and so we create setups like this all the time because we want it to play into our story. It's like your story is to maintain the righteous bully and your story, and it's not the righteous bully because I think, you know, that's where we kind of move a little bit from this, is that like the inner villain and the way that it shows up is the default for a lot of people. We can move past that by stewarding the story and all of a sudden the setup doesn't have to be the setup anymore.
Right? Okay. So if I want to change my story, because for the last 15 years, our story has been, he's in charge of the trash. He always fucks it up. I always have to come in behind him and monitor it and mental load it and this and that. And I get resentful. So like the new story could either be A, I just take over the whole task myself, but I'm scared that's going to lead to resentment later.
Right.
Or B, I just make it fun. And I'm like, hey, it's the night before trash day. Let's all go do it together. And then it's like one and done. Or C, I just take care of it, but I find a way not to be mad about it and resentful about it, which I'm not sure how.
Right. And that's what I have a suggestion for.
So tell me, if I'm looking at this like a story, how can I change the story?
In this story, you're the savior. In this story, it's very like, it's right. We say it's righteous bully, but you can see the kind of enticements of both the obedient critic and the vengeful martyr. Right. And that it's like, I do everything. This was funny because in this text chat, you even said this to me. You were like, but I do everything. I do everything. Right. And it's like, you have this story that you do everything. But if you zoom out, Eric does a lot. It's just in a very different context. Right. And some people might consider what I'm saying being apologist. Right. Like, oh, well, you're just apologizing for Eric not doing the tasks. And I'm like, no, the story that you have is that you're the savior and that you are the one and that like you ask him to do the one thing and he can't do the one thing and you have to come in and save it, right? That could be one version of the story. And so your job is to say, why does it serve me to be the savior? Why does it serve me to do this? And can I actually look at this in a different perspective to recognize that sometimes Eric's the savior, right? Sometimes Eric's, you know, like, and kind of fundamentally change the desire for you to be the savior of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also just being sick of the story. Like I'm sick of every trash day being villainous in my thoughts and my tone and everything. Like I'm just, you forgot the trash again, you know, like I don't want to be that anymore. I'm just done with that. So I think it's also a question of looking at the story and deciding you want to shift it. Right.
Exactly. Because, you know, we look at this idea of equitable work and equitable everything. And what we recognize is that, you know, in the end, when we get rid of the story, things end up shifting anyway, usually for the better. This is what I'm trying to say is that like, when you're in the confines of a story, you doing any work with the same belief structure, with the same story structure of you being the savior is always going to lead to resentment, because that story leads to resentment. You're the sacrificial in that story, right?
Right.
And so when you're in the confines of the story, you cannot, no matter what action you take, no matter what clever thing you try and do, you're still operating within that story. And you are still going to be sacrificial. Either you're going to be righteous or sacrificial. Either way, you have to no longer want to participate in the story in the same way. And then all of a sudden it resolves in the most magical fucking way you can ever imagine. Right?
Well, and I thought of another option is I can just let it go completely and then just see what happens when he misses the trash truck. Like, what will happen? We'll just have a lot of trash piling up and it'll have to go somewhere in the garage. Or I mean, that's another story, is for me to just let go of the trash having to be taken on trash day.
And then you also, which means you also let go of all the succeeding parts of that story, which is the drama that you may feel or want for this could be event, you know, that we're not going to name this one, but you know, this is like the drama that you could feel because it's like, you can't park your car in the garage. Right. Or you can't do this, or you can't, you know, I mean, there's so many stories that can follow downstream. And if you truly let it go, if you truly let go of this idea of I'm sacrificing, right, or I'm being righteous, and you just let consequences be consequences, right, and just like, and you fully like get on this curious, fun train of like, let's see how this is gonna fuck up. This is exciting, right? And it's no longer sacrificial. It's just a fun, curious game. That's one way of changing it so you're not in the story anymore.
Right. So it's kind of like a choose your own adventure, and you get bored of choosing the same page. So you're like, well, let's just see what happens if I don't remind him that the trash is coming.
Yes. And I don't care. Or what happens? Can I fundamentally look at my responsibility and my idea that the trash has to go out, and I have to, and I'm going to have to, again, sacrifice. I'm going to have to deal with all of the downstream things of the trash not going out, and I'm not going to be able to clean the house, and I'm not going to be able to do this. If you're just like, I don't care. I'm just going to let all of this go. Everything associated with this task go.
It brings a lot of anxiety up in me. The idea of the trash not going out.
Yeah.
Like stinky garage, wolves, raccoons, possums. Like, it's just a lot of.
I don't know about wolves, maybe coyotes, but yes.
Oh, well, coyotes, not wolves. There was a coyote on our front porch yesterday. That's why I've said, but. Yeah,
is it really? Well, that's that is a trickster energy that just showed up on your front.
Oh, porch. He keeps pooping on our porch.
Coyote has a lot of lessons for us in terms of like, and I feel like Coyote is actually really good at playing the story, because Coyote basically, Coyote is the fool in many ways who will force us, will make things so absurd that we have to recognize it's a story. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah. So I'm wondering what his role is in this. Because
just look at your role with Cookie, right? Like, Cookie just came into the recording a thing, and it's like the kind of having to hide from the dog, and the dog has this, like, there's a story with Cookie going on. And the fact that you now have another canine pooping on your front porch that you then have to clean up is probably a part of that story, right?
Right. Yes. It's so weird, right?
That's what I'm saying. It's so weird. It's so, everything is so absurd. It's like second rate writing, man. It's like,
yeah.
Like, I know this is.
Or
like,
really deep writing. I just can't see the symbolism.
Right. Well, but I mean, it's like this, it's like I say, you know, and this is bringing up current affairs, in which we kind of know the times that we're living, but like, you know, that the last name of the first interracial couple whose court case went to the Supreme Court was Loving. So it was literally United States versus Loving. Like, that was their fucking last name.
Wow.
And then you have the recent events in which all the slogans are for good because of the death of Renee Nicole Good. And you're just like, what is going on? Like, why is it that, like, how is it that somebody with the last name Good is now becoming this like symbol? You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's just, there's weird stuff like that I see all the time in so much of my work. And I'm just like, this is bad writing. I don't get it. Right? I'm just like, oh my God. Anyway, I could go on and on.
So wait, I know we just got off on a total tangent there, but I want to go back to what you just said. Do you think that there's a possibility that your clients aren't necessarily obedient critics entirely, but you see it more because it's what you know more?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. I think that yes and no. So this is my point, is that like, if you, okay, so this is the practicality of what it means to have a story. You are, if you experience being a righteous bully, right? And this is how it's like, this is what it's like to work with me, honestly, because this is what tends to happen, is that if you come to me because you're like, I'm a righteous bully, right? Which I will sometimes have righteous bullies, not as much. I usually will, you know, either you can pick any one of the villains and say that. They'll come to me and I'll give an obedient critic example. They'll be like, I feel like an imposter. I have imposter syndrome. Those words help me know that somebody's an obedient critic, because when people use people pleaser, imposter syndrome, stuff like that, perfectionist, I'm just like, okay, we're dealing with this energy of this story. Like, it's like it's like it tags itself so that I can recognize it when I'm working with people, right? And they could have so many other villains that are key, but usually when they come to me, they have a problem, right? And they're just like, I am seeing, this is what my world feels like. I could have picked up on any pattern. I could have picked up on any word. I could have picked on any story, but right now this is the story that is most prominent in my life. And what will happen is that when I say it's an ecology, when I say it's like a universe, everything in the world just starts to organize itself around that story. It's like all of a sudden, it's like you go into some VR reality and it's like everybody is questioning whether or not you should belong, or your self-worth, whether or not you are doing something, right? It's like you just start to get into this, like, it feels designed in many ways, right? It's like the whole world just becomes the lens of the story when you become really deep into it, especially when you're processing it. And then that makes it easier for us to be able to understand and identify it. And so you asked me what the practical version of this is. Honestly, one of the most practical things that I have come up with it is that you can know your own subconscious. It's not actually sub, and it's not something unknowable.
Mm-hmm. I'm starting to think it's like all Sankara is just villain stories.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. Sankaras, if you think of the Buddha and you think of cause and effect and craving and aversion, he's taken a tiny portion of a story and chosen that story. You know what I'm saying? And saying like, this is a Sankara, but the Sankara is just one little chain link in an entire story. And he's detaching from his attachment to the story. Right?
Right. Like when he says, oh, house builder, I see who has built this house, which he's talking about, for those of you not familiar, he's talking about the endless cycle of birth, of endless karma, which is sankara, which arises from craving, aversion, and ignorance. You know, like maybe it's the story, the addiction to the story. And it's funny because we're so addicted to stories, like entertainment, literature, music. It's all stories telling stories.
It's it. That's it, right? And so if we recognize that our reality is built in that, and I'll give you an example of what I mean by this, is that, like, you know, I think that trauma then no longer is the beginning of something. It's the middle of something, right? It's like the middle of the story. And unfortunately, or fortunately, or whatever you want to say about it, like, that can feel really bad for somebody who wants to stay in the victim position, right? But a story that is governed by the drama triangle is always going to be extremely difficult. And the faster that you can turn that story and steward it into more the empowerment triangle, the better, right? In which you don't have to be the kind of victim of whatever it is. You know, I compare it to the understanding of the fact that, like, sometimes I get in fights, or I used to do this a lot more. And have you ever done this where, like, you're in a fight and you're saying these things, and then you suddenly get to be the observer of that fight, and you're like, why the hell am I saying this stuff? It almost feels like you're being run.
There's a script and you're having to just read it.
Yes, exactly. Have you ever gotten that feeling?
Definitely. And then like sometimes I'll have the wherewithal to be like, eh, I don't really mean it. I don't really care.
Sometimes you'll, and you just jump out of it, right? And that's what, and that's what I mean. I think that when people have this sense of the matrix, this is the matrix that I, as I see it, right? That it's like you see the stories and you're like, I could follow the script and I'm going to decide not to, right? I was joking with someone the other day that I was like, they joked about winning the lottery. And I was like, you can't win the lottery until you're an eternal child. If you want the eternal child arc, because eternal child's very easy come, easy go, right? Which is why if you want the story of winning the lottery, then you also have to get in the story of the eternal child, which means that you're most likely going to lose the money, right? And that if you look consistently, that the vast majority of all people who win the lottery lose it within 2 years. You know, you're just kind of recognizing that you are playing the part in a story. And I'm kind of going a step beyond belief for probably some people to say, okay, great. All of these traumas are just chains of events. I just happen to be experiencing a portion of that chain in my lifetime, right? Or they're all sankharas and I am dissolving the sankharas at the smallest level so that I get detached from the story, or I can steward the story and I'm not, you know, attached to it in a way that's, you know, irreversible, right? You know what I mean? Like I have no choice. We talk a lot about choice, and I'm saying, yes, that's true. And I think that there are nine to 12. I won't complicate things. I think that there are 9 stories that we tend to gravitate to and coalesce around.
So when you say in order to win the lottery, you have to be on the internal child arc, can we jump arcs consciously?
Great question. Yes. So this year I decided to work on my hungry shapeshifter arc because I was doing a lot of content creation. And I noticed that whenever I got in a place of like wanting attention, as opposed to just being in presence, I made really crappy content. And I was like, hey, if I want to be successful as a content maker, I'm going to actively go into my hungry shapeshifter arc. And I'm going to use that as the concentration for my year. And what's happened as a result of that is that, like, I think that that shift and that intention to go into that arc and to purposely cultivate it, like I'm watching movies that are in that arc. I'm like doing everything I can that was in that arc to kind of activate that arc within myself. And this sense of being outside of time and place and that nothing has to do with me, I feel like is a direct result of trying to activate that arc and move it and activate that story in my own life, right? It's like I consciously chose to do it.
You're consciously choosing to observe it, but you're not necessarily consciously choosing to behave in that way, right? Or are you?
I know some basics, which is I know that this is the thing about behavior, right? I think that behavior is 95, maybe 85. They're saying 95% out of our control in many ways, right? It's like, it's exactly like we're saying, it's like we're in the middle, we're reading a script. We don't know why we're reading the script. We're just doing it, right? And as soon as you are able to break out of the script of that story, that's when you have the choice to say, okay, I'm not going to do this in this way, right? So it's like for me, if my attention is really important, a really important part of the hungry shapeshifter arc and being present, that's my practice this year, is I'm just going to work on being present. And what does that mean, right? It's like the thing that I can control is where my attention goes. And so I am choosing to do something that I know that this arc has to work on.
Mm-hmm. And so the hungry shapeshifter is the eternal child and the vain controller?
The eternal child and the vain controller, yep.
So it's funny because I've been looking at my own hungry shapeshifter.
I mean, have you really?
Yes. It's so funny. For 2026. Yes. That's so funny. I think you might have told me, and maybe unconsciously I'm applying it, but I'm starting to see the ways that I am a hungry shapeshifter.
Okay. Tell me about it.
Well, my need for things to always be clean, like constant cleaning, it's a way of being hungry. It's like hungry for a clean, tidy environment. And then like cooking, I'll get like hyper fixated on, say, sourdough bread, and I'll make it 20 to 100 times until it's absolutely perfect, and I could make it in my sleep perfectly. And then I'm on to the next thing, like, you know, like the next project, like, right, you know, like, I'm going to start making yogurt now, you know, like, and so it's like, I feel like there's an element of hungry shapeshifter in this, like, hunger, passion for the
craving.
They're all similar. They're all similar things, right? Like it's all a similar genre. It's cooking, or cleaning, but yeah, I'm noticing this hunger for it. And like going to the gym, like I'm hungry to work out. I'm hungry to get those endorphins. I don't know if that necessarily is shapeshifter stuff, because I don't necessarily identify a lot with the eternal child, but in some ways I am, right? Like financially, my husband runs everything in the finance department. I don't know anything about our mortgage. I don't know anything about any of that stuff. Like, doesn't that, isn't that a very eternal child of me
to just, it is.
Skip through life without knowing how bills are paid or where they're paid?
Yeah. I mean, it is to a certain extent. I think it's a very, it's in general the same as like illusion villains, which is like, it's kind of very like, oh yeah, whatever goes, whatever happens. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just kind of going to go with it. And again, I don't think it's a judgment at all. I think that that's a really important thing, because if you recognize that, you've talked a lot about how your dad has very strong ADHD. Is it okay if I say that?
Oh yeah. He loves it. He wants to be the poster child for ADHD.
And the ADHD is the, if you correlated a clinical diagnosis with a villain, the hungry shapeshifter is ADHD, is the personification of ADHD, right? And so if you recognize that the seven in the Enneagram, or the throat center in human design, that same one, there's so much hyperfixation in there that is like hungry for the next thing, or hungry to be the best at this, or hungry to do this, like to get kind of recognition, even if it's only self-recognition, for like all of these different things that you're capable of doing and all of these different, it's like, it's kind of, it's very, very heavy on craving. If we were going to go back to totally Buddhist tenets, right? Of like, just wanting more and to be the perfect aspect of this, or be the perfect manifestation of this. It's just like your just insatiable desire to conquer all of these different areas, and in turn maybe get recognition for that.
Right. Well, what's interesting is you're talking about your sister and you carrying the same scar as your mother, and how these stories are inherited. Like, my mother was righteous bully. I definitely in 2025 worked a lot on my righteous bully. And then 2026, I'm working on hungry shapeshifter. And I believe my dad is the hungry shapeshifter, like the cutest version of one, right? It's interesting. Like, maybe that's a good place for people who are listening to start, if they've already attacked. It's not the word, but if they've already dealt with their primary villain, maybe they could analyze what their parents or guardian, like the people who had a lot of influence on them growing up, what their primary villain was, and then work on that. I also think, isn't it interesting that you and I were both talking about how certain villains marry other villains, and they're kind of like opposite ones, right? Like the illusion one will marry the control one, right? Yeah. Aren't they illusion based? Tell me again, the illusion based.
The 1, 3, 5 and 7 and 9, 1, 3, 5, 7 and 9 are the control villains. I call them anchors. And the 2, 4, 6 and 8 are the illusion villains. I call them drifts. And they will almost always marry each other in some capacity. If you have mixed roles in your relationship, right? In the sense that like your sexual relationship, one person could be the control and the other person could be the illusion, or one person could be the anchor, the other person could be the drift. But in your chores, it's another thing, or in your providing, it's another thing. So, you know, relationships can be complex, but I do believe that a person has a predominant energy of being either control or illusion.
And so I don't know, have them memorized. Can you just say quickly, the control ones are 1, 3, 5 and 7, 9?
1, 3, 5, 7 and 9. Yep. The obedient critic, the vain controller, the evasive expert, the hungry shapeshifter, and the invisible destroyer. The illusion ones are the vengeful martyr, the eternal child, the divisive immortal, and the righteous bully.
Okay, so if an illusion and a control get together, like in my case, it was righteous bully and hungry shapeshifter, so that fits. And then I often see, like at my work, obedient critic with eternal child. We've talked about that. So I think it's interesting that an illusion one and a control one will often procreate, because whether or not you're raised by two people of the same gender or non-gender, like, it does take a male genitalia and female genitalia to create a baby, right? And so the baby is then born of the two sides of the,
yeah,
an illusion and a control.
Right. And that, and it can be anybody, anybody can be it, no matter what, no matter. And that's the thing that I find. I was talking with somebody this week who's in a same-sex relationship. And it was fascinating to talk about the dynamics and how they're completely the same, but again, same shifting that happens in my relationship, in my hetero relationship. Right.
Mm-hmm, yeah, totally.
So if that makes sense, let's go back to what you were talking about the hungry shapeshifter and with healing the hungry shapeshifter, because inevitably you will be somewhere in that arc. And that's the thing. You will be somewhere in that arc, no matter what you want to do. Right. So the hungry shapeshifter has subtypes of the thief, which will take credit for things that they haven't done. It has the defensive. So they're going to get super defensive about just about anything, especially if they get accused of wanting to do something for attention. And the covert form is the entertainer, right? Like, you're always trying to crack a joke or make everybody feel at ease or something along those lines. And, you know, this one is all about time, attention, and like, what are you doing with your time in a lot of big ways, right?
Mm-hmm. And if we took all the villains away, what's left?
That's right. That's right. You mean like in terms of like, I mean, well, that's, I think that's kind of the idea, right?
Is I guess that, the legends, yeah. The legends would just
the legends,
come up.
The legends. So the legend of the hungry shapeshifter is the fabricator. They take all the different interests that they have and all the different loves that they have, and they make a life out of that. Right. Mm-hmm. So yeah. Mm-hmm. In the process, they have to give up the need for attention. That's like the hero part, but yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, that's it.
Well, before we end, I just wanted to give a little exercise or homework, I should say, that came to me through one of my best friends from high school. And I thought it was just genius because she is going through this huge issue in her town. A lot of things come up with this. A lot of people being cruel to her, mean to her, whatever, because she's taking a stand against something. And she was told me that it's really stressful and she's not used to stress. Anyways, so one of the ways she's dealing with the stress is she's just telling herself it's all a part of the story of her life. And she's like, okay, this is the part in the story where the protagonist decides to be brave. Oh, okay. I'm in the chapter where I'm sad. I'm in the chapter where I'm angry. I'm in the part of the story where I have to come up with a plan. This is the plan making process. So she's just said that that was one way she's working on stress, is to take a step back and to see it, the story of it. And how does she want her story to go? And I thought that was a great exercise that anyone could practically do, whether you know your villain and you don't know your villain. Oh, and she's been doing the villain work, which is why I think it led to this, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or recognize that at any point you can make a choice to flip it. You can make a choice to invert, and you can make a choice to steward your story in a very different way, right? It's like, you know, I feel like there's a lot of freedom in knowing that you can't change. You can't fundamentally kind of move out of the arc. Everybody has it, but you can change how it shows up in your life.
And going back to what I was saying last week about that book I read about the woman, the Holocaust survivor, just saying that feeling imprisoned and being locked in has everything to do with not recognizing what choices you have. And I think when you realize, hey, there's 9 other stories here, and each story has sub stories and legends and heroes and villains, then you have a lot more choices to make, right?
Exactly. Exactly. And that's exactly, you can use that same language with the righteous bully story that we talked about earlier with the trash. So many ways you're imprisoned in this intractable problem, and you can at any point choose to move out of that story or to steward that story in a very different way. So I would love to hear everybody's thoughts, what you guys think about this. It's funny because I've been to so many different events where people have talked in the same nature of just like, oh, these are the stories I come from. We like think about it all the time and we talk about it all the time, but it doesn't become this collective. I'm kind of trying to be more comprehensive than just like, oh, this is the story I came from. It's like, I think it's a lot more intentional than that. So I would love to hear everyone's thoughts about it. If you agree, disagree, anything like that. So thanks for listening, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of This Spiritual Fix. If you are interested in finding out what your primary inner villain is, you can go to www.christinawiltse.com to take the test that is linked. That's KristinaWiltse.com. Thanks, y'all. And remember,
humility, gratitude, acceptance, done.
Hi, y'all. Christina from TSF here, This Spiritual Fix. I wanted to invite you to my Substack, where we are about to start a series on the inner villains, the parts of us that sabotage, control, or quietly hide when things get hard. These upcoming posts will walk you through how to recognize them, work with them, and eventually transform them. They're going to be a wonderful complement to what we're hearing here on TSF. And if you are a paid subscriber, you'll also get a new meditation each month to support that integration. You can find it all at ChristinaWiltse.substack.com or search The Life Alchemist. Thanks, y'all.